from the Sky News Centre at 6. The youngest woman to be convicted of plotting a terror attack in Britain has been jailed for life. 18-year-old Safa Bulla will serve at least 13 years in prison for planning a grenade and gun attack on the British Museum. The sister of a midwife who's not been seen for a week is appealing for help in getting her home where she belongs. Samantha Eastwood was last seen leaving the Royal Stoke Hospital in Staffordshire last Friday morning. Her sister Gemma says she's caring, harmless and gentle.
Samantha is a fantastic woman and friend. She's warm, friendly, loyal, kind and generous with a great sense of humour. And whoever she is with will always make their times together fun. Samantha was determined to become a midwife from a young age and succeeded. All of Samantha's work friends describe her as an amazing midwife.
A man who threw a baby out of a window in Luton has been jailed for a minimum of 12 years. A passerby miraculously managed to catch the child by his legs as he fell last August, saving his life. 31-year-old Sean Zeimlis, who's from the town, had already seriously hurt the baby beforehand. The government's facing criticism over Amazon's tax bill. The online retail giant was asked to pay £4.6 million for last year, £2.8 million less than for 2016. It's despite pre-tax profit. It's nearly trebling. Heather Self from accountancy firm Blick Rothenberg says everything's above board.
Amazon give a lot of their employees part of their salary in the form of the right to buy Amazon shares. That's a valuable right, so it counts as income for the employees and the company gets a tax deduction.
Harvey Weinstein is trying to get the criminal case against him dismissed. The film producer is charged with sexually assaulting three women. His lawyers claim prosecutors have deliberately hidden evidence which would clear him. In sport, England's cricketers have put the first test with India back in the balance towards the end of day three. A short time ago, the tourists were 78 for five. That's the latest. I'm Amelia Cox.
It's Bristol. It's Friday. It's 6 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. I'm Tony Gosling. Helping me review this week's news is Deputy Mayor Asher Craig. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 7 o'clock news, another good cause bites the dust. The Campaign for Press and Broadcasting Freedom, along with its periodical Free Press, copies of which are available here in our studio, will be closing down on or by the end of November this year. We're joined tonight by the Bristol contingent, Mike Jempson, a man who's been there almost from the start of that campaign, and set up a journalist rights charity MediaWise here in Bristol too. He's now helping run the Bristol Cable Magazine Collective. We asked what the milestones have been over the last 35 years and why the Campaign for Press and Broadcast Freedom is folding, just as UK press and diversity is arguably at its lowest ebb. And technology races forwards. The last people to notice seem to be our lawmakers. There's no UK or international law at the moment governing lethal autonomous weapons. That's the killer robots to you and me, with chilling adverts showing how easy it is for a drone to kill anyone to order. Where is the law? What's the United Nations doing? And why are Google employees and academics in the United States putting pressure on their parent company, Google, to disengage from its private military contracts, which could see your online browsing behaviour used to add you to the latest drone kill list? Equally worrying is Israel's secret programme to skew debate and to alter Wikipedia, also reporting online as it uses armed forces against civilians on the ground. Summer's chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots in the second hour after 7 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 16 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs around 27, pretty hot. Sunny intervals and a gentle breeze, thank goodness. Next week, highs of 27 again. Getting cooler, though, as the week progresses. Plenty of sunshine. No rain. Next weekend, that's the 11th and 12th of August, highs around 24, cooling down a little bit, sunshine and a few showers. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news is Cabinet Member for Communities. Well, it's quite a lot. It involves its public health, public transport, libraries, parks.
Transport, not transport.
Isn't it?
Given that one, yes, that's Councillor Vary Throttle who has transport.
Events, equalities. Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's Deputy Mayor Asher Craig. Hi, Asher. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, how are you?
I wonder if you could just start off, because I know you were involved in this Bamboo Club, which extraordinarily was started partly by, or helped anyway, to keep going by a white person, even though it was Afro-Caribbean.
Well, it was set up by a white person. And yes, I wanted to pay my respects to Tony Bullibon, who is known around the world as a world-renowned yachtsman. And everybody knows him for the 4 days that he was sailing around the world and his boat upturned. And everybody thought he had died, but he actually survived in his boat. The Australian Navy found him and rescued him. For those of us, his friends and family here in Bristol, he's known as a philanthropist and somebody who helped Bristol's black communities in the 60s and 70s and set up the Bamboo Club, which was the first multiracial club in the city.
Why was it called the Bamboo Club?
I have no idea why he called it the Bamboo Club. I'm sure it relates to, kind of bamboo, Jamaica. I have no idea, so don't ask me that. One claim to fame definitely for Tony is that Bob Marley, when he first broke out of Jamaica, the Bamboo Club was the first venue in the United Kingdom that he actually played his set with the Wailers. So there's a claim to fame. But on top of that, Tony had been very involved in the cricket club, St. Paul's Carnival. He helped a number of black individuals set up small businesses. I mean, he was, Uncle Tony to some. He was a really great man, and his legacy will continue.
You mentioned Carnival there. What do you make of it? At least it's back, isn't it?
Yeah, it's back. It's back. Obviously there
under
has
new
been
management?
Some criticism. Yeah, it's under new management. There obviously has been some criticism, but my response to people is if you didn't like key elements of it, then kind of get involved and try and fix it. I think we're going to be reviewing and going over the good bits and the bad bits, and ensuring that 2019 will be just as successful as this year.
Well, I suppose the other thing is, if you don't like it, don't come.
well, exactly. And that too, but I think there has to be a realisation that, the carnival has grown. 50 years ago, it was, just a few hundred people. Now we're talking over 100,000 people. That's a huge event to manage. Same along the lines of how we do Pride and the Harbourside Festival. So there's a lot of work that goes into kind of planning, a carnival of that size. And I know that some people feel that, because we've changed the footprint and it's gone a bit broader, it's become it should be culturally. It's about the African Caribbean culture, but it's open to everybody to share in that culture.
St. Paul's is starting to get a bit gentrified, isn't it, Asher?
It is. Didn't start it, so don't put the blame on.
Okay, apart from that enormous piece of rubble, which is where the factory used to be, I think. They used to make corrugated paper, and that was all flattened. There were various other bits flattened. What is happening with that? Do you have any idea? Because it's been there for years.
So there's a couple of spots. So the one I thought you were talking about is the one near St. Werburgh's, which
that's
is Brooks the former.
As well, yeah.
Yeah, so that's the Brooks's factory, and I know that there is going to be a housing development put on that site there. we are looking at a huge housing development on the Dove Lane. That's where you're talking about. So we are talking to, have advanced discussions, I think, around the development of that site and looking at a myriad of housing.
They were talking about some sort of giant skyscraper originally, but I don't think that's
I don't know. Anything is possible. We're an urban city, and I think in order to address the growing housing problem that we have here and the fact that we lack a lot of space, we have to think about going up because we can't spread out. We're not, we're hemmed in by our neighbouring authorities. So, yeah, I'm all for high.
Is it social housing?
It will be a combination of social
housing. Now, the thing is with these developers, Asha, you know as well as I do, they like leaving these things, don't they? They don't necessarily like to do the building straight away. They quite like leaving it, especially if gentrification is going on. They like leaving it maybe 10 years or so until the house prices in the area have gone up, and then they like building.
No, well, I would say the development on the Dove Streets site is with a local social housing provider, so we are working with them together on the development of that project, so it doesn't help them to kind of leave it lying there for it forever and a day. So we will be ploughing ahead, and I would say you need to invite on Councillor Smith, who can give you more details about where that development is going.
Yeah, it'd be also nice to talk to the developers too. Some negative news about the council this week, though. Apparently some sort of chaos, they say in the Bristol Post, that about? Bristol City Council have missed the financial accounts deadline. We did hear that the accounts were all going to be in order under the new mayor, Marvin Rees. Mm-hmm. But councillors have criticised its auditors after unforeseen items meant that Bristol City Council has missed its legally set financial accounts deadline. A cross-party group of councillors hit out at external auditors, BDO, for not completing its annual accounts before the statutory deadline. So this is, I suppose the council will be saying it's nothing to do with us. This is the auditors.
I suppose the facts, we've missed the deadline, but I think it's only by, I'm not sure, because I haven't gone into the detail. I am not responsible for kind of the financial aspects within my own portfolio, but I do know that it's nothing that's going to, yes, there is criticism, but the fact that we've missed the deadline, I think our team are working with the auditors and government to ensure that
Councillor Anthony Negus from the Lib Dems has been chatting to the auditors.
He says he would have something to say.
He says that this is because the City Council has not handed over certain things it's supposed to hand over to the auditors. So the blame is bouncing backwards and forwards.
I don't know. I'm not going to kind of get into that argument because I don't know the
BDO have said that 10 items which are yet to be fully covered in the working report, including the alleged £70,000 payment to the council's former chief executive, Anna Klonowski, previous £100 million undervaluation of the council's heritage assets, which includes buildings and artwork, and confusion over the Avon pension funds also causing a headache for the accountants. Now, I guess what you'd say is that Marvin is really trying to make sure all the boxes are ticked, and sometimes that's just going to cause delays.
I suppose so. I'm not really able to comment any further on that subject. Councillor Cheney is responsible for that particular area, and we will ensure that everything that they need.
Let me try on another story.
Yeah,
then,
you can try.
Which
me on
is
another story.
Which is from last week. We mentioned it briefly last week, which was pretty worrying. And this is about the mums who've taken Bristol Council to court over £5 million send funding, which is for special needs, and they've won a case against the council, which is really to do with delays to special needs assessments. And now this is quite important for those kids, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, no, definitely. I'm somebody who many years ago I had responsibility for funding special educational needs in school six forms and colleges when I worked for the Learning and Skills Council. And even then it was still an issue. There is just the need outstrips the money and the resources that we have. And so, yes, I know that the I heard this afternoon actually that we had lost the case. It just means that we have to ensure that we undertake the assessments, but the issue is the resourcing to enable us to pay for kind of some the placements, which are extremely expensive.
It's
money at the end of the day.
Well, yeah.
And government need to give us more money to enable us to pay for the services for children with very complex needs.
I mean, is there any pressure you can put on central government just to come
we
up
put
with
pressure someone? We put pressure on the government all the time, all day, every day. Likewise, the local government association.
But I mean, how can you? Because they'll just say no, won't they?
Well, exactly. So what do we do? We can't rob Peter to pay Paul, but we're getting squeezed left, right, and centre, as with every other local authority around the country.
And
so.
What Jos Clark, who was here last week, she was the previous chair of audit, was saying was that council staff have been told not to open emails which are from parents with these special needs assessments.
Oh, I don't
because
know.
As
I
soon as they open the emails, the clock starts ticking.
I don't know. I have no idea about that. I don't know.
Okay, so anyway, let's
how true that that's not true. I don't think so.
Well, I mean, some way has got to be found, doesn't it, to not have to, especially when
we do, and that's the point. Because if government isn't giving us any more money, it means we have to make some really difficult choices about what we do deliver and what we don't deliver. And we've already had the ongoing arguments about kind of libraries and parks, etc., etc. But something has to give, and I always say, one thing somebody said to me, I think it was my daughter actually, who said to me, "Mum, no child ever died going into a library, so people need to check things that the needs of children safeguarding, adult safeguarding is extremely important, and something has to give, and the demand is there's no denying, and it's going to, because remember, people are growing older and living longer, and as I said, we're seeing more and more complex needs coming through.
But that's good for you, surely, because it means there's more people paying council tax.
Martin,
can I
but
ask
then
Martin?
remember, we're not keeping all of it.
Martin, can I just ask you to just take us through some of this tug of war going on between ASHA and local government and central government at the moment?
Not me personally.
Well, it's the central government have set up local government to fail, basically, and because they know that major cities like Bristol are controlled by the opposition, then, of course, they can just sit back and eat the popcorn while the council struggle to square the circle here of finding enough funds to do all of these things that are statutory. And of course, things like special needs are statutory. Yeah. You've got to do them.
Yeah.
And of course, they're going to withdraw all central government grant in 2020.
Yes.
And that means that somehow you've got to do all the statutory stuff, which means you can't do any of the non-statutory stuff. And I feel like saying to the people campaigning for the libraries, including the Liberal Democrats and the Tories, is you said there should be an austerity policy. That means your library has to close. And you can make a fuss. And of course, what they do now is this. They now are mobilising people against the cuts, which their policy has created.
Exactly. And so hypocritical of the other parties. But, that's the game that is being played. And particularly as we are a Labour administration. And I see it with all Labour administrations across the country. We're the ones who are getting squeezed. If you look at some of the Tory administrations, I mean...
Well, the standard spending assessment has been rigged, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah, of course it has.
The East Dorset lost the least, and Noel in Merseyside lost the most.
Mm. Well, we've seen one local authority kind of...
Oh, yes, that's what's going to mention
Northampton.
It's about to go crash and burn completely.
Yeah,
Tory run, and was even pushed as an exemplar for everybody else. This is going to be a cut price council, the cut council tax. Mm. They've made no attempt to try and preserve services at all. Mm. And in actual fact, they've crashed and burned first. But they're all going to crash and burn.
Mm.
And I think the problem with discussing local politics on the show like this is that people haven't adjusted to the new reality, which is that local government is in a total crisis, and people haven't really understood it.
No, and I think one of the things I had a meeting in my local ward a few weeks ago when we were talking about toilets, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said that she had no appreciation for the fact that we send our council tax back to central government, who then divided up amongst all the other 348 local authorities across the country. So everybody thinks that the money that we collect in council tax stays with the local authority. That is not the case.
It's only a fraction of the money's required anyway.
Well, exactly.
Because the standard spending assessment underpins all. The council tax was only brought in
completely.
It's poll tax mark two.
Yeah.
And of course, it's very regressive. Mm. In Northern Ireland, you've still got the rates. They never dared to bring in community charge poll tax there. Mm. And of course, their local government is better financed.
I mean, Asher, do you ever feel like an official receiver just deciding what's going to be the next thing to close?
No, it hasn't reached that stage. But I think I'm constantly always looking for alternative solutions. And so some of the work that we are doing around helping to develop a much more sustainable communities and calling on other key partners across the city, because we're all in this together. Everyone is getting the squeeze. It's not just local authorities. Police are getting the squeeze. Health is getting the squeeze. We're all getting squeezed. And at the point is, when you pull one lever, the others aren't working. So we're actually talking to our other partners in ways in which we can actually work together and come together to try and square this very difficult circle.
Let's hope it doesn't get like Northampton here.
It's never going to get like Northampton. Yes, you heard it here. You can repeat it back. It is never
going
to get like
Northampton. What they've said over there is that the council has called emergency talks amid warnings. Mm. It is going to have to breach its legal duties to vulnerable children.
Mm. It's got to do that, or it's got to set an illegal budget, which you can't do without being surcharged and all the rest of it.
Exactly.
And it's the Tories who've backed themselves into that corner in Northampton. Mm. But of course, it's going to happen. I think it is going to happen everywhere. And of course, if there's a further economic disturbance, as there may well be.
Of course, there's going to be an economic disturbance. Yeah. Let's not get it twisted, okay?
No, that's right. The idea that it's all fixed is just wrong, isn't it?
It isn't fixed. God, we have no idea what is facing us with the whole Brexit debate, and let's not go into that. It's not just that.
It's also the financial services sector is still completely
What's
out
Martin?
Of
we've had this interesting little hike in interest rates. I remember years ago at the BBC, we used to have this thing we used to call the voice of God in the ceiling, and every time interest rates changed, the voice of God from Broadcasting House would come through and say interest rates have been raised 0.25% or something like that. This is considered to be very important, obviously, for many people. Probably the most important impact is on people's mortgages, but it's now 0.75%. Is this actually significant? What's going on here this week?
Well, it's significant in the sense that they're raising them at all, because some people would be suggesting that they shouldn't be doing that with Brexit's uncertainty so on. So some of the economic commentary I've been reading this week is saying it's perhaps unwise for them to do this. Mm. But I think the real problem is that all over the world, central banks are starting to tighten up the monetary policy that has been so open. I mean, the only thing that's kept everything going for the last 10 years is that they've basically printed money hand over fist. There was a big dollop of quantitative easing after Brexit vote, for example, and the interest rates have been at historic lows. Mm. I mean, this is a ridiculously low interest rate. And on that basis, the economy can sort of look as if it's doing something. Mm. But as soon as interest rates rise around the world, the possibility of a collapse rears its ugly head straight away.
Of course, the other big effects of interest rates, for anyone with some savings, and of course most of us haven't got any, but for those lucky people that do, it means they can't, Martin, put their money in the banks. It just doesn't...
No, so in other words, they're then forced to, if they've got any savings, to invest it in the stock market.
You mean gamble, don't you? Which means, of course, pushes
stock markets up. Mm. The stock markets have been artificially inflated by all of this, you know, jiggery-pokery behind the scenes. And basically, the wealthy classes who own assets have had their assets protected by government intervention, and the costs of the crisis have been passed down to the people on the bottom rung who see their libraries and toilets close and all the rest of it. And that's what's been going on all behind the scenes all along.
Okay, but what would you do?
Well, what you do if you're going to bail the banks out, which is what
I mean,
we did,
if you were in the Treasury,
if we're going to bail the banks out, which is what everybody agreed we're going to do, then you nationalise them and you run them. You know, basically take over the commanding heights of the economy and you run them. And of course, if there is another crash, we're not going to bail them out and then just give them the money and say carry on as we did before next time. We shouldn't have done it the first time. But the political power of the financial services sector is so great that having been bailed out, they then went back to doing exactly the same things as they were doing before with our money. And of course, they can get away with it. and they have been getting away with it. But if they hit the wall a second time, I think people will be once bitten, twice shy.
Well, one of the effects has been the near closure of our libraries here in the city, which is awful for people that use them, and particularly for youngsters that love to go in there, parents like to go in there, maybe even leave the youngsters around while they go and look for books, get records, DVDs, all that sort of stuff. Asher, how did you manage to keep the libraries going? And is there still this kind of horrendous, I suppose, it's sort of Damocles hanging over them?
Okay, no, it's not a case of Damocles hanging over them. I think we now have an opportunity to really look at modernisation and reform of the library service. Okay, let me say it again, the library service. Okay, I think so many people were getting so hung up about kind of the buildings known as libraries. But let me give you the reality. Over half of the libraries in the city, the footfall was near enough negligible. So we were operating libraries and hardly anyone was using it. Now we can go back. I'm not here to do any kind of faint blame game, but what I'm really interested in is what and the mayor is interested in is what we need to do to really bring our service up into the 21st century. So we want to have digital inclusion at the heart of the work that we are doing. We are looking in areas where there are a myriad of different assets and resources, not only owned by the local authority and or others or other public sector bodies, to see whether or not we can look at co-location. We can look at communities maybe managing the buildings, but we're still delivering the service, but we're developing a whole range and a wraparound range of kind of different services to be delivered out of those libraries. We are talking to young people. We have been talking, and I will say, I do need to clarify a point. I have never said that libraries were ever going to close. I did. Obviously, everybody assumed they were going to close because we were no longer going to be funding all 27 libraries. Of the 17 that had been identified as no longer putting any funding resources into, 16 organisations had come forward with a range of different proposals on ways in which that they could sustain that particular building and, again, deliver a whole range of wraparound services so we could still have a library, but we could also look at, you know, kind of cafe meeting room spaces, looking at, like I said, digital inclusion, adult learning, coding, you name it, it would be happening. And I've also had the opportunity of looking at other libraries, both in the States and in Europe. So taking some really good ideas and, like I said, really ramping up the pace and really working hard to
kind of change the concept. So the idea is try and get an income from the library too.
Not necessarily just an income per se. You know, it could be that X community organisation could take on, you know, so I'll give you a scenario. X organisation could take on the building known as the library in a particular community. Bristol City Council would still run the service, but we could pay that community organisation the rent for running the service out of there. But we could develop the site and actually have meeting room spaces, make it an attractive asset that, you know, increasing the footfall.
It's just,
so
it's just people one of those
are going
things.
In, yeah.
I mean, I don't want to be too cynical. I am quite
you
a cynical
can be
chap.
Really cynical.
I'm quite a cynical chap sometimes. But, you know, what the council sometimes does is it farms a service out to another organisation.
The intention is
when
not
that organisation collapses, the council says, oh, it's nothing to do with us.
No, the intention is not to farm out the services. We will still deliver library service. We will just deliver it in a different way. Some will be retained in the buildings that we currently have, but we are asking our local councillors, local communities to sit down and kind of talk through, well, what is it that they want from their service? How can it be, how can we kind of increase that footfall? What can we do with that building? How can we enhance it? Actually, is this the right place for the service? Could it be co-located with the surgery down the road that's PFI? You know, because we've got some doctor's surgeries in some parts of the city where they, the rent is killing the rent. You know, the payment of the PFI is actually killing them. So we need to look at ways in which we can deliver a kind of different model bring it, like I said, into the 21st
century.
Like,
it sounds to me like you've been quite successful in getting people in the community to come up with
ideas.
Oh, yeah,
they have been brilliant. Listen, the one thing, let me explain. I always said at the very beginning, the one thing about Bristol, you know, we are a creative city. Come on, we got Engine Shed, we got Aardman Animations. We're not lacking with people with intelligence and kind of put some ideas together. And you heard it from Marvin about kind of Banksy's proposal. And he's got a whole raft of ideas that he's planning to share with us. And you know, and we'll see what we can do with some of those and build that into the vision.
Sounds fantastic. Well, anyway, let's. Is there still going to be a problem when it comes to 2020? Do you think, or will we be able to get over that?
I don't necessarily, because I think over the next 2 years we're going to see how the library service is going to kind of start to reshape. So you know, kind of, and some will kind of move quicker than others. But like I said, we have there is potential. We're looking at bringing in some additional funding to look at the whole digital inclusion, adult learning agenda, and how we kind of bring that into the heart of some of our libraries.
Well, another thing you're responsible for is the bear pit.
Yeah.
And that actually is not looking good at the moment. It's kind of Harris fencing gone up. Everything's been painted brown. It used to be kind of public art space. And before we hear about your plans, I'm going to go to a woman called Lisa Furness.
Sure, of course.
And Lisa was one of the people who used to curate this public art space. So she's a bit disappointed that it's now all been closed. You know, she can't put all that artwork up there anymore. And it's been closed. So let's have a listen to her take on this now.
Somehow, people have got confused about the difference between street art in a neighbourhood and free expression in a neighbourhood and violence and drug abuse that might be occurring. So there has recently been a rise, or a reported rise, of violence and drug abuse in the Bear Pit, which I would argue is due to a rise of homelessness, the spice epidemic, the massive cuts to social services, and the massive cuts to the police force. But some people seem to have found it easier to say that it's because the People's Republic encourages street art and political expression in the Bear Pit. So as a quick fix, we've been generally kicked out of the space. The whole of the centre of the Bear Pit has been reclaimed and painted brown by Bristol Waste, really as an incitement to taggers. I don't think you can walk through there at any time without seeing brand new tags that have turned up in the last 5 minutes. Just before the bank holiday, on the Friday before the bank holiday, they demolished the Cube, which PRSE have been curating for several years as the only non-commercial billboard in the city centre that discussed political
ideas. I find it quite interesting that the council picked that to take away, because that is, the like you say, the only non-commercial billboard.
And we are genuinely shocked about this removal of the freedom of expression from the Bear Pit and what this says about the priorities that the city has generally. Basically, we've been evicted. And the question is, does the populace of Bristol want a free, open, creative space that anybody's allowed to get involved with, or would they prefer everything to be locked behind closed doors?
Now,
and
you know what?
Money?
I wonder if it's got anything to do with the stuff that was actually in the national news back in the Remembrance Days Sunday last year in 2017, where we had Mark Weston, who's the leader of the Conservatives on Bristol City Council, objecting to one of the bits of art about the First World War.
Yeah, so believe it or not, that mural and that full exhibition in the Bear Pit was produced as part of a workshop that was being that myself and a couple of other members of PRSC ran in partnership with Creative Youth Network and Journey to Justice, celebrating the lives of activists and important political leaders who've been overlooked by history but who've made an important impact onto Bristol. Now, the words themselves were actually a direct quote from Walter Ailes, who was Bristol MP and pacifist and a campaigner on a lot of different rights for a long time. The quote was taken from his testimony while he was being court-martialed for being a conscientious objector, and it was his explanation, his own words, explaining why he was refusing to fight. For this text to have been declared to be offensive because it was the centenary of the war in which so many people died and in which so many people who were conscientious objectors genuinely had the opportunity to stand up and say, this is the moral stance that I'm going to take and these are why these things are wrong. I think debates about the right and wrongs of mass warfare have probably raged quite strongly since that point. And we were there and we put it out and it was absolutely shocking when it was removed. I would never have anticipated that for a moment.
I wonder whether it didn't go down too well with the Bristol establishment.
Yeah, and I mean, I can see why no one likes to read things that they don't agree with, but whether that should give you the right to remove the message.
Mm. Well, that's Lisa Furness, who is curating that bit of public art space for People's Republic of Stokes Croft. Asher, it might have been actually kind of conflating two different stories there. One is this one from last year with the piece of artwork that was taken down. I mean, what was said on it was he described Walter Ailes, the former MP, Bristol MP and conscientious objector, described the slaughter in the trenches of the Great War as a cold-blooded murder and crimes against God and man to maintain the honour and glory of the British Empire. Quite an important little statement to make, and it's quite nice, isn't it, for any artist in the city to know that there is that public space, but there isn't at the moment.
Okay, so let me just clarify something. Okay, so taking back control of the Bear Pit, we agreed that the tunnels, the walkways, they would continue. The graffiti artists are free to continue to put up their artwork, etc. There.
In the underpasses. Yeah.
We took a decision because it's not just about a graffiti. Because the problem with the graffiti is that what we have, it's those people who do that tagging. I've looked at it. You know, people have no respect for some of the graffiti that is there, and I have nothing. I have all respect for the graffiti artists. But you walk through the tunnels, it's really dark. People have even kind of graffitied on the lighting, etc. So we have to, we have to improve the security and the lighting in that area. In terms of painting out the space, we did it again because there was lots of tagging. There's no real murals on the walls that are there, but I have now had a conversation with a few individuals, and two of the walls within the Bear Pit will be painted with murals. We're having the Broadmead Improvement District Board are going to be talking to local graffiti artists to do one wall, and the other wall we're going to have a conversation with stakeholders. I've asked officers to liaise with the local councillors and other key stakeholders
so
to agree
bit bit.
What
you're saying. It's bit by bit. It's coming back.
I'm not saying no, it won't be totally coming. no, not totally. Well. Like I said, I have nothing against murals whatsoever, or the graffiti. It's how people have no respect for it by all this endless tagging. I was in Miami a few weeks ago, and I went to the Wynwood district. Look it up, Wynwood, and it's like a business improvement district area, but it's completely and totally dedicated to arts, culture, kind of graffiti. And I wouldn't necessarily say that is the right space.
I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put a link up to that on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So if you go to thisweek.org.uk I'll put a link up to that so you can see some pictures of this place.
Wynwood District in Miami, absolutely amazing. And I think in terms of we had Upfest at the weekend, I'd like to see kind of us have a dedicated area in the city, and you know, Upfest is in Bedminster, and I think we can kind of build on that and look at how we can enhance and kind of bring new businesses, new life into the area, which is what they've done with Wynwood.
There's some pretty amazing artists impressions.
There are
the way
amazing, yeah.
But what about what Lisa was saying there about conflating this whole thing of drug abuse with street art?
Don't conflate the two. I'm not even going. The street art and the problems that are going on are two completely different things. And we can't ignore the fact that people are openly taking drugs in the middle of the day, you know, kind of injecting themselves. We've got the spice epidemic. We've had a death there, prior to the decision that we took. You know, there was a lot of kind of intimidation going on between street people and some of the traders that were there. And, you know, we couldn't continue to ignore that. So we are going to be putting up... we're looking at putting up some CCTV in the middle again to keep it safe. So traders have slowly started to come back into that space.
None of that stops the street art being curated by the people who were doing it before, does it?
Like I said, I don't. I've always said I haven't got an issue with some of the street art that is in the Bear Pit, and as I said, we have designated spaces in the Bear Pit that art can continue.
There's been all sorts of little things going on, like the removal of the plaque. There was a plaque put up, brass plaque, to a guy called Punk Paul.
I don't know what happened there. I think I understand that that was during the cleanup. I don't know where the plaque is. I have no idea. I don't know who took it down. It was obviously taken down during the cleanup where we had loads of volunteers that were there.
Probably.
Possibly.
But there's also this thing called the Cube, which apparently £2,500 of public money went into that, but Bristol Waste turned up and just took it down. I mean, there were calls to the police saying that this was criminal damage.
No, it wasn't criminal damage. It was taken down. It never had planning permission
If you don't have planning permission for something, the council has to put an enforcement notice, and they have to go through a process, and then they can take it down. They can't just turn up and knock something down. Otherwise, that's criminal damage.
Well, I don't know. Take me to court.
Well, the planning system does that. You know.
Well, I'm not a planner, so I don't know the ins and outs of the law.
The advertising hoarding. We're going to be doing some more stuff about this next week with Adblock, a campaign in the city.
Yeah.
But I mean, it's the only place where you've got individual artists who have got a space where it's like a kind of normal big advertising hoarding, but lots of people see it. The campaigns that were running there before the Cube was taken down was, for example, if we bailed out the banks, we can afford the NHS. Join the fight, your NHS needs you. Hope is the fuel of progress and fear is the prison in which you put yourself. That's a quote from Tony Benn. Mm-hmm. But more importantly...
Yeah, but there was some other stuff that were there that were kind of like disrespecting...
Council, certainly. They were quite poking fun at the council.
Yeah, I remember my partner driving around and he said, oh, have you seen this? And he said, how can you allow people to...
Well, it's called free speech.
Exactly. And it's really interesting that, you know, on the one hand, everybody says, oh, you can't have advertising. You can't have advertising in the city. But, allow us to have our own advertising
just
space.
Just before the Cube was taken down, there was a Friends of the Earth campaign up there where they said, warning, you're now entering dangerous and illegal air pollution. 297 deaths per year associated with air pollution in Bristol.
Yeah.
So, I mean, is that right? Is the air pollution in Bristol illegal?
The air pollution in most cities is over the illegal limit. But as you know, we're currently consulting on a new air quality, zoning of the city centre and surrounding areas to try and reduce the amount of pollution coming into the city through diesel and other fuels.
So do you think Bristol artists should have the right to criticise the council?
Sorry?
Do you think Bristol
anybody has the right to criticise the council? Everyone has a right. You can write in, you can send a letter, you can come to council and make a statement. You know, there are ways in which you can do that.
Martin, this is a public space. Slowly but surely, the artists are starting to return. But obviously, the main problem here seems to be that problems with drug abuse and homelessness seem to have been used to really completely change the way that an area of public art is being used. And actually, you know, this was recognised around the world as quite an important site. And obviously, by the national press, when it came to taking down this Water Rails poster last year.
Well, I remember I was involved in the Speaker's Corner events, which we had down there with the Civic Trust before it was changed. And it's always been a problem down there. I mean, it basically used to be a no-go area for, you know, standard folks before this all came in. Well, to some extent, but I mean, yeah. I think that's the problem is that you've got a problem with homelessness. And
yes,
yes, and so on.
Exactly. And you know that we are doing our best. No, but you know that we are working really hard to try and address that.
One of the things that when we had the event down there some years ago now, one of the speakers who got up to speak was from the Seventh-day Adventist Church up the road, and she'd been doing lots of work with the street people down there. And she said, if we're going to improve this area, we've also got to recognise that these people have to go somewhere, and they've got to be included
I have
and I think that was the tension of always trying to do this, is to try and improve it, get traders in there, art in there, but you're not trying to clear the homeless out completely either.
No.
They've got to be allowed to have the space. If they're not going to go there, they're going to go somewhere else.
There's got to be
give and take on all sides to try and make it work. And, you know, let's hope another solution can be found.
Well,
a usable space instead of just a no-go zone.
Well, I think there, you know, in terms of the medium to long-term future, you know, I'm waiting on the outcome of the consultation to the city centre framework, which incorporated the Bear Pit as part of that consultation. There are, kind of proposals for, you know, the site. Some people have already seen the traders that were there had put forward a proposal around the circle, but you know, it's just one of hopefully many proposals. And one of the things that I really want to do is I want to talk to the people of Bristol and ask the people of Bristol what you want to do with what is it's a key site. It's the gateway to the city. You know, you come north, south, east and west, you pass through, you have to pass that site. So, you know, and you and think about the people who live, you know, you've got the hotel, the people in the who live in the housing block immediately over the Bear Pit. You know, everyone has something to say. And equally, as people say they want to retain the space for X, there are maybe double the amount of people who want us to do something different with that space.
Got to ask you about Brexit. Where do you think that it's going to mean for the city, Asha? We've had this week fresh calls for a stand up against Brextremists. And now the city itself voted against Brexit, but the country as a whole voted for it. It's a bit awkward, isn't it?
But you know, I'll put it on record. I voted to stay in Europe. I remember that morning because I fell asleep during the vote, and I could see it slightly kind of going towards Brexit. And I think I fell asleep hoping that I would wake up the morning and think, oh, okay, it's kind of swung back. And I actually got woken by my daughter about 6:45 in the morning. She rang me. She lives in London, and she rang me, and this was her first words to me. What have you done? What have you done? She was really distressed, and I'm like, what are you talking about? Because I had no idea. She said, you've ruined my life. She said, I'm now going to have to marry my boyfriend in order to keep my European passport. You know, what about us? But you know what? But I did say to her, well, the other issue that you had is, did you vote? Right? Did you, as a young person, vote?
Did she?
She did, actually, because I forced her to. I forced all my children to vote. But I think after Brexit, they became even more kind of politically minded, even at the last election. But I think with Brexit, oh God, it's I'll say the one thing is that, you know, Marvin is doing a great job bringing the city outside of the UK and looking globally at how we can kind of link up with other cities all over.
Are we going to have a referendum to split with Westminster then and go off in our own direction?
I'd love to, no. wouldn't that be great?
We could have checkpoints on the M32.
Yeah, but the reality is, more and more, we as cities are the ones who are taking the bulk of everything that is going on. So whatever decisions are made in Westminster, it's the cities who are feeling it. The world does not revolve around Bristol. We have 10 core cities, Bristol being one of them. But we punch well above our weight, even in terms of the contribution that we make towards the GDP. So, we are a successful city, but there's still a way to go. And I think the fact that Marvin and other key stakeholders kind of went out to Brussels, because he was the first leader in the UK who actually went over and met with the EC about how we can continue to have a relationship.
Do we need another referendum? Do we need another vote, do you think?
We need another government. We need the Labour government. That's what we need. That's what we need.
Roll on
a general election. But these buggers are not moving,
but
are they?
One of your party members this week, Peter Mandelson, has claimed that a fresh referendum would empower Theresa May to stand up against the Brextremists' blackmail. There's an independent newspaper has got a campaign for a final say on the Brexit deal, which has got 200,000 votes, only 16 million to go, folks. So, Martin, what about you?
Can I just say something? I'll tell you one thing. I think I would prefer, I would love to have, not necessarily a rerun, but a final decision on whether or not we do or don't. And the reason why, like I said, young people would have swayed it for us and they decided not to vote. And I think in the last general election we saw, even though Labour didn't win, we saw a massive increase in the youth vote. And I feel that if we were given the second opportunity, we'd romp home.
So we got it wrong, did we, the first time?
Yeah, we did. I don't care. I'm saying it. Yes, we did. Got it wrong.
Okay,
because the vote wasn't representative of the whole nation.
Anyway, we've got no Prime Minister's questions at the moment because Parliament are off on holiday. Yeah. So what we do have, though, is we have the annual speech by the Mayor of Bristol and various of the party leaders. So let's have an extract from that now, which talks about the cultural life of the city.
Yeah.
And we're committed to inclusively growing our already strong cultural offer. We have saved the venue that will soon no longer be known as Colston Hall for the future, leveraging support from the Arts Council and city partners. Our cultural investment programme requires every arts organisation in the city to demonstrate inclusivity and diversity if they want to secure council funding. By working collaboratively with our media sector, the second largest media sector outside London, Bristol has been shortlisted to be Channel 4's new national headquarters. This would bring a huge boost to local opportunities for young creatives and provide a catalyst for creating meaningful talent pipelines. That has been a huge achievement to get shortlisted, and we continue to work for Channel 4 to come to Bristol. And regardless of their decision, bringing together the media sector will in and of itself provide future opportunities for our city.
Yeah, I can't deny we were slightly disappointed that we're now no longer in the running for the HQ, but we are still in the running for regional centre for Channel 4. And I have to say, I'm someone whose cup is half full, not half empty, and I am quietly optimistic that in spite of the fact that we may have missed out on the big one, I feel that Bristol has so much to offer, and as you heard Marvin say, in terms of kind of arts and culture and media, it's second to none in the city. So let's watch the space and see what comes.
It does seem to be a no-brainer to me.
We've got Arman, we've got everything going on.
Talking about the TV channels.
Yeah.
They're all based in London. Four, five,
every
Sky,
single one of
everything.
Them.
Can't we have our own national TV channel here in Bristol? We don't light a fire under the posteriors of the rest of them.
Well, one of the things that we do have, because remember, even though we have BBC here in Bristol, you know, we are, you know, the Antiques, you know, we've got some real kind of golden nuggets, you know, around natural history programs that are made in Bristol and, you know, Antiques Roadshow, et cetera, et cetera. Aardman Innovations, you know, so we've got some great great media outlets here in the city, but they need to learn to think outside of the box. World does not revolve around London, but I also understand that the North wants something too, so yeah, let's see what the decision will finally be.
We're having it first, actually. Yeah. Right. Anyway, it wasn't all sweetness at night at the meeting, because the Green leader, Eleanor Comely, had some criticism of the way the city's run too.
Oh, well.
We've heard a lot of beautiful words today. We keep hearing a lot of beautiful words. But the gulf between those words and the reality of the actions I see and what people around me are experiencing is so huge that I can't be silent. I find myself like the child in the nursery story who just can't help blurting out that the emperor isn't quite as well dressed as he thinks. And I can't keep myself from speaking out. I had a look at some of the words from our council's organisational values to see how we're doing against them. Words like respect, care, grace jar against actions like firing people who've worked with you and for you for years without even having the decency to speak to them yourself. Words like collaborative suggest a willingness to ask for other perspectives and respect different opinions. They don't sit well with launching harsh public criticism the instant your colleagues don't come to the conclusion you want.
That's Eleanor Comely, who's the leader of the Green Group on the City Council. Some pretty strong criticism there. She's saying effectively that Marvin's good on words, but not on actions.
Well, so were they. I have nothing to add to what she has. She is entitled to her own opinion. But I know that we're talking to a whole range of individuals, and we do take on board what people want to say. When we look at the consultations that we've had, we listened and we adjusted our decisions accordingly. So maybe because she doesn't like the fact that we may not listen to everything that they have to say, that's where the criticism is coming from. But trust me, we're talking to more than just her party or the parties.
Well, what about the other criticisms are that the committees which are supposed to scrutinise what the council are doing are now being chaired by Labour people rather than opposition people?
It's no different in Tory council. Tory-run councils, all their scrutiny is chaired by Tories. You don't hear anybody bleating about that. So nothing further to add, you know.
Martin, this whole principle of the way that councils are supposed to operate is that it happens in central government, it happens in almost all local authorities across the country, is that the opposition parties will chair these kinds of scrutiny commissions, and that enables
that's disputable. I mean, no. I said we should have checked this when we were discussing this last week. In actual fact, we've actually reverted to type. We used to have an all-party coalition in Bristol, which was unique in the country, frankly, because of the legacy of George Ferguson's rule.
Once the Labour's in, Labour's...
Well, I mean, the fact is, it's just become almost the same as Manchester, the same as Liverpool, the same as Birmingham.
Okay, well...
That's what's happened.
Mm. Time now for the Murdoch News at 7. Thanks to our guests, Cabinet Member for Communities, Deputy Mayor Asher Craig. Also, join us after the news as we look at the global picture and take a look at press freedom.
This is Bristol's BCFM on 93.2, online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.